Thank you. It's always a pleasure to come and talk here. But before I talk, I want to start with kind of an apology for the older members in the audience. It would be part of the talk will sound like a voice from the past. And the same part will sound to the younger members in the audience like, what is he talking about? I'm not going to say who is in which part of the audience. So we invented the term minimal string theory, and because this term really has two meanings here. One is that we're like toy models, exactly solvable models that often teach us things. And these are the simplest examples of string theory. They have the smallest number of observables, and everything is calculable. The hard thing is, of course, to interpret it. What does it all mean? And to find different calculational schemes. And I'll talk about that. So this is one sense in which this is the minimal version of string theory. The other one is more technical. It uses what is known as minimal conformal field theory. So this is a conformal field theory coupled to two-dimensional gravity. This is the description on the world sheet, and the world minimal is also appropriate there. So our motivation is to take a solvable model and try and solve it from as many different points of view as possible, which I'll list in a second, and understand the relations between them, hoping to find new insights. So this was more or less the motivation also some 15 years ago, so what's new? So several things happened during that period. First, we learned about D-brains. In fact, D-brains were really, I think if one can easily make the case that they started in the context of these models. We learned a lot about non-perturbative phenomena in string theory, and maybe it's time to revisit these old models in view of these new developments. The second thing that happened is that in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when these models were studied, they were studied mostly from a matrix model point of view. But the world sheet techniques which allow us to connect to space-time or to things that we want to understand in other models, have not yet been that developed. So over these last 10 years, mostly through the work of the Zamolodchikovs, these world sheet theories were understood much better. In fact, they're completely solved. And so maybe it's time to go back and try and make as many connections as possible between the world sheet description and space-time. So these are our motivations, the technical ones. But the thing I would really like to focus on is the bigger question of what's the fundamental formulation of the theory? How are we supposed to think about it? And this is perhaps the simplest example of holography. We have a holographic theory. This is the matrix model. And a holographic dimension of space-time pops out. And as we will later see, it pops out in more than one way. So in string theory, we are familiar with the fact that we can assign different space-times lead to the same physics, for example, t-duality. But this often happens when you have a compact space. We are not that familiar with the situation where the holographic dimension can grow in more than one way. And I'll try to make a case for something like this here. So these are the big questions we would like to address. And in order to do that, let me first set the scene. There are really three languages. And I'll be very careful to state at every step in the talk which of the three languages I mean. The first is the world sheet. We take a minimal conformal field theory. This is kind of a module that we take. And we add to it another free field, another interacting field, Liouville. It's very important that it's not a free field theory, it's an interacting. Most of the fun that we are going to have here is associated with the Liouville interaction. Now, just to connect to, for the expert, I would say that in the 80s, most of the work was turning on the lowest dimension operator on the world sheet. There, the world sheet is really very complicated. We will not do that. We'll turn what is the two-dimensional cosmological constant, and I'll explain it in a few transparencies in more detail for the non-experts. The second language is space-time. These are the simplest examples. We're doing string theory in one Euclidean dimension, this Liouville direction. The target space has some conformal field theory, which has a finite number of operators, times a non-compact direction phi. So it's roughly speaking, strings propagate propagate is perhaps not the right word. Strings live in one Euclidean dimension, phi. There's a more elaborate version of the theory where we add time. It's richer, but less tight. So these models are more tight, and that's why, after working a little bit at C equals 1, went back to these tighter models to resolve some of our confusions. The third language...
Are the holographic dimensions also Euclidean?
Yep. But everything in this talk will be one Euclidean dimension, which will be the holographic dimension.
I see.
We do not build time as a holographic dimension. In fact, nothing here has Lorentzian signature. That's why I said the word propagate is perhaps not appropriate. Because Euclidean space, nothing propagates. The third language is the matrix model. And there is also a quote-unquote holographic dimension. Lambda is the eigenvalue of the matrix. And it has been understood long ago that phi is not the same as lambda. So we can think of the thing as strings as living in one dimension, but this one dimension is either parameterized by lambda or parameterized by phi. So the relation between these two formulations is something we would like to make more precise. One thing that we will see here in this talk is that by studying the theory, starting from the world sheet, a certain Riemann surface will pop out. So I'm not going to assume anything about the matrix model. I'm just going to play with the world sheet techniques, and a certain Riemann surface will pop out. I will not ask for it, I will not assume it, it will just be there. And we can think of this Riemann surface as being a quote-unquote target space for the string. Tell you the punchline, this will be exactly the same Riemann surface which is central in the discussion of the matrix model. So this will lead to a kind of a derivation of the matrix model starting from Liouville. So for the experts and the people who've been through this period in the 90s, there was always the question, what is the eigenvalue in terms of Liouville or in terms of the world sheet? What is the operator that measures where the eigenvalue is? So now we are smarter, we know that the eigenvalues are D-brains. This is something that I'll make a lot more precise here. But there's still the coordinate X, where the eigenvalue could be. What is X? How can we measure X with the world sheet operator? So I'll answer this question here. And finally, I'd like to remark here that phi and lambda, being distinct, are really conjugate. It's kind of a t-duality between lambda and phi, and we have two conjugate space-times for the same system. So this is kind of a general introduction. So let me give the outline of the talk and tell you where you can go to sleep and where you should wake up again. I'll start with a review of minimum conformal field theory, mostly in order to set up the notation and to remind other people what it is. Then I'll review results from Liouville field theory. This is, again, a two-dimensional field theory. Then I'll put the two together and put BRST and so forth, and that will lead to the definition of minimal string theory. Nothing new up to this point. Not only nothing is new, nothing is younger than 15 years here. I'll then turn to two different aspects of the theory. Both of them will be algebraic in nature. The first, it will be the study of the ground ring. This is new. The existence of the ground ring was pointed out more than 15 years ago, but its application for this system was not done for some reason. Actually, I think it was not done because Liouville was not understood well enough. So I'll show how some of the results which were obtained in the 80s, in the 90s, and many, many new results can be obtained in a more conceptual way using the ground ring. The ground ring will give us two-line derivations of lots and lots of results which were surprising at the time. So that would be one thing that we'll do. We'll then study two D-brains. Over the last 10 years, there has been a lot of progress in understanding D-brains in Liouville theory. We see that the theory has all sorts of peculiar D-brains, which are not common in standard descriptions of D-brains. I'll review the work that was done here. And then I'll put them again in the minimal string theory, and I'll collect lots of bizarre features of these D-brains. So this would be the end of the algebraic part of the talk, around here. And it will sound to you like if you want to decouple, this is where you should should decouple through this discussion. It would be long, there would be lots of details, a lot of facts, totally disconnected from one another. And if you like algebra, then algebra in the math sense, not in the sense that you do a lot of algebra, then you will like that. There will be a ring, there will be relations in the ring, and so forth. I'll then give a geometric interpretation. And maybe I organized the talk differently. I should have started from the answer, and then all the other results would be, they trivially follow from the geometric interpretation. But I'd like to really point out here that I do not assume anything about the geometric interpretation. So I'll collect all the facts, and then the geometric interpretation will just come out. And here, we will see a certain Riemann surface, contour integrals on the Riemann surface, will give a geometric interpretation of all these D-brains, which are otherwise very singular. And I'll have some conclusions in future directions. So let's go to work. I have one transparency on what minimal conformal field theories are. They are labeled by two relatively prime integers. I take by convention P to be less than Q, and they have a fixed value of the central charge. A one-parameter family of subset of them is unitary. The rest is not unitary. And these field theories have lots of marvelous features because they are associated with special Virasoro representations and so forth. They have a finite number of operators whose dimension is given by this formula. They are labeled by two integers. There's a finite number of order p times q over 2 of such operators. And when we multiply two such operators together, we find a linear combination of other operators. Now, this is called fusion rules. And it is a lot like in SU2, we take spin J1 with spin J2, you multiply them, you get linear combination of spin ranging from J1 minus J2 to J1 plus J2. The coefficients here are 1 or 0, depending on whether the representation does or does not exist on the right-hand side. In the actual calculation, when you multiply things, there is a reduced matrix element, and that's, in general, a complicated number. So in these examples, when we look at the operator product expansion of two operators making a third one, the operator product coefficients are known, but they are horrendously complicated. Complicated expressions in terms of products and ratios of gamma functions and sometimes other functions. It's really complicated, but known. So this is my review of conformal field theory, minimal conformal field theory. So let's talk about another conformal field theory. It will be another module in this construction. This is Liouville field theory. So Liouville field theory has a scalar field phi, has a kinetic term, and then there is a term e to the phi. The second term, e to the phi, has different names depending on the interpretation we assign to this theory. If we think of it as a string background, we call it the tachyon condensate because we have a function of the target space, potential. If we think of it as two-dimensional gravity, we call it Schwarzschild cosmological constant. And I can always set mu to 1 by shifting phi. Now, in order not to clutter the equations, I'll set mu to 1. The only time I cannot do that is when mu equals 0. This is a singular point, which is most of the activity was in the 90s, but it hides most of the beauty of the theory. So it's very important that mu is not 0, and then I can shift it to 1. There's also a linear dilaton, or a term proportional to the Schwarzschild curvature, coefficient q. So that the central charge is not 1, as it would have been if we have only a scalar field, but it's 1 plus q squared. Is there a pointer? Now, what are the observables? Before we had these operators in the minimal conformal field theory, here the operators are exponential of phi, and they have a dimension, which is some quantity squared, depends on the exponent alpha, plus a certain constant. Unlike the minimal models, here we have an infinite number of operators. We have an infinite continuum operators, and they will be used later. So this is what happens for generic alpha, but special values of alpha are interesting. So if alpha takes special values, labeled by two integers r and s, then the dimension of the operator e to the alpha phi is such that for this value of the dimension, the Virasoro representation is special. They are null vectors in the representation. And that means that for these fields, the fusion rules are simple. And this is actually where the exact solution of the theory comes from. You focus on these special Virasoro representations. You derive their correlation functions. And then by factorization, you derive other correlation functions. That's the essence of what's being done. It's enormous technology. It's very complicated, and it's very beautiful, and I'm not going to review it here. I just mentioned there are these special representations. So now we're going to put these two pieces together, trying to make a string theory out of it. So we need to make the central charge 26, and I wrote formulas before for the central charge of the conformal field theory and the central charge of Liouville. Putting it equal to 26 determines the Liouville coupling constant B to be B squared E B P over Q, the two integers of the conformal field theory. So what are we going to do now? We determine B, all the parameters are fixed in terms of these two integers. This is what labels which theory we have. And we now construct physical operators. It's again very standard. We take a primary operator from the what we will call matter. This is the conformal field theory. We multiply it by an appropriate Liouville exponential, such that the dimension of this whole object is 1. This is a standard thing. Then we either integrate it over the wall sheet or we multiply it by two ghosts, C and C bar. So how many such quote-unquote tachyons do we have? Well, for every primary in the minimal conformal field theory, we have such a tachyon labeled by these two integers. So we had before all the P times Q over 2. Here I exchanged the range, so I didn't have the over 2, but I have an identification between tachyons with different labels. All this, I think, was known in 89 or so. So there's really nothing new here. One of the surprises in 89 or so was that this is not all there is to the story. In addition to these operators, which are very similar to what we normally do in critical string theory, there's an infinite number of other operators at other ghost number. And this was the work of Dian and Zuckerman. And again, we just follow our nose. We have to enumerate all the operators in the BRST cohomology. We make a list of all of them. There's an infinite number of such operators. Those at ghost number 1 are the ones I talked about before, but there are also many others at other ghost number. Particular interest among them are those with ghost number 0. Ghost number 0 are special because if we multiply them together, we find another thing which has ghost number 0. Another way of thinking about it is that if the operator we talked about before are integrated over the Wolchi, these are inserted at a point. And it doesn't matter which point we insert them in. This is where BRST comes in, but they are inserted at a point. So what are they? Well, they're given also by some Virasoro primary and some Liouville exponential and some polynomial in Virasoro operators and ghosts act on them. The details of this are not going to be important for us. The only thing which is important is that out of each Virasoro primary in the matter, we construct two O hats, two such ring operators. Now, why do we call them a ring? Imagine we multiply two of them. They both have ghost number 0. So the product has ghost number 0. They are in the BRST cohomology. So the thing on the right-hand side is in the BRST cohomology. There's a finite number of such operators. So we multiply two of them, we get linear combination of the same beasts. So we can have a multiplication table. And these things multiply almost like numbers. All the complexity of these being operators in the conformal field theory and ghosts and BRST and doing a functional integral, all this is gone. They multiply almost as if they're numbers. And I'll try. This is what I'm trying to make more precise. Okay, so imagine we multiply two of these guys. Every one of them, O hat, has a certain Virasoro primary here. So if we take one times the other, whatever can appear on the right-hand side should have the same form. So it is constrained by the fusion rules of the two matter parts. Similarly, the operators that appear here in Liouville are again turn out to be on the list of this degenerate Liouville representation. So what appears on the right-hand side is constrained by the fusion rules of the same operators in Liouville. So just by imposing these restrictions, we can completely nail down the fact that I'm going to mention here. So I'll just mention the answer, and I will not go through the derivation, and I'll give another derivation of this fact later. So what are these rig operators? The simplest of them is just the identity operator. This is clearly a ghost number 0 operator. We insert it on the string wall sheet at a certain point. It clearly doesn't matter which point it is. So this is the first of them. Then there are these two labels, the 2, 1, and the 1, 2. We'll call them X and Y, and they generate the ring. By taking products of these, we can get eventually the whole ring. And the thing stops. It's a finite dimensional ring. Now comes the nice thing. The operator labeled by RNS can be written as a polynomial in X and Y, which turns out to be a polynomial in X times a polynomial in Y. Well, these are Chebyshev polynomials. Since I learned about Chebyshev polynomials only recently, I feel like it's appropriate to remind you what it is. So this U R minus 1 of X being cosine theta is sine R theta over sine theta. This is clearly a polynomial in cosine X. And the way you prove identities of these polynomials is you write them in terms of trigonometric functions, use trig identities, and then you express the answer as polynomials in X. So these polynomials are very beautiful because they are, on one hand, they are polynomial, and on the other hand, they have all these nice things of trigonometric functions. And we'll see some of these nice features of these polynomials. So I claim that the ring element with labels R and S is given by such product of such Chebyshev polynomials. And if you don't like Chebyshev, just think of it as being sines. They are sines of a certain angle. And the difference between the different operators is the label here. It's sine of the basic angle theta times some other multiplier. So let's review some or derive some obvious properties of these Chebyshevs. This object sine s theta over sine theta is an SU2 character because it's a trigonometric function in exponentials, so it is an SU2 character. Imagine you take two SU2 characters, different values of s, and you multiply them. When you multiply SU2 characters, what you get on the right-hand side can be written as a linear combination of SU2 characters with coefficients being 0 or 1. You don't get 1.3. So not only are they a complete basis, but when you multiply them, you get on the right-hand side things with integer coefficients. This is known as the representation ring. Take the fusion rules, kind of multiply spin J1 with spin J2. You get sum over different spins. And this the property is that if you take replace every representation by its character, the formula is still true, and the character is this Chebyshev. So Chebyshev with one label times Chebyshev with another is written by a finite sum of Chebyshevs with coefficients 1. So this is basically why the whole story works. The ring elements now we see, when we multiply them together, we'll find linear combination of other ring elements, but with coefficient 1, 1 or 0. But the ring has finite number of operators, finite number of elements. Remember, it was of order p times q. So we have to impose a relation in the ring. And the relation in the ring is that the first one just keep going up, and the first one that doesn't exist, we just set it to 0. So a certain polynomial in x equals a certain polynomial in y equals 0. So the way we multiply ring elements is now completely mechanical and simple. We think of x and y not as being operators, but by being numbers. And we multiply, we decompose the answer in terms of these Chebyshevs. We use these relations to simplify the result. And what we get at the end is the answer of multiplying these ring elements. Okay, so this is the description of the ring. And this guarantees that the ring, round ring multiplication is simple. Now, it's important to think, to try and think about the same problem in the old-fashioned language. What we have here is a product of two conformal field theories, this minimal conformal field theory times Liouville. The operator product coefficients in both of them are horrendously complicated. It was noticed already in the 90s for very special correlation functions that when you take them together and you multiply and you turn the crank, all the mess from the two pieces of the theory exactly cancels out, and we end up with simple answers. I think this is the conceptual reason why in the end, we end up with answers which are 0 or 1. The whole thing comes from the fact that these ring elements, when you multiply them, must have these 0 and 1. And I'll give more examples of that. Now, imagine we had the cosmological constant not 0. Imagine the cosmological constant was 0. Then this whole structure that I talked about becomes very, very trivial and uninteresting. The whole part of SU2 is that if you take J1 times J2, two representations, you have a linear combination of representation. You do not just get the representation J1 plus J2. the analog of setting mu to zero is getting only the representation with J1 plus J2, ignoring the fun part, which is the non-abelian part in SU2, which is responsible for the other representations. They are down by powers of mu, and if you set mu to 1, the coefficients of them are exactly 1. They all come with coefficient 1. Let's go back to the tachyons. The tachyons have ghost number 1. So when we take a ring element, which has ghost number 0, times a tachyon, which has ghost number 1, we should get something of ghost number 1. We just repeat the same story. It has ghost number 1. There's a finite number of them, so we get a certain sum over such tachyons. What does it mean? It means that we can think of the tachyon with labels RNS as being a ring element RNS acting on the basic tachyon. More algebraically, it means that the tachyons give us a ring, give us a module of the ring. Roughly speaking, you can think of it as a representation of the ring. The ring acts on the tachyons, it gives us back a tachyon. The coefficients that appear here, which I'm going to determine, the coefficients that appear here are give us the representation. We can think of these O hats as being a big matrix that acts on all the tachyons. We already see that we are going to get some simplification because we write this T as O hat acting on a basic T. And then we've already learned how to multiply O hats. This gives us a linear combination with coefficients 0 and 1. And therefore, the coefficients here will also end up being 0 and 1. Again, the same simplification from the ring propagates to the module. But I said that there are twice as many ring elements than there are tachyons. Therefore, in the tachyon module, there should be another relation. Roughly speaking, if we think of representation theory, the tachyon module as a representation is not a faithful representation. Certain ring elements, which are in general non-trivial, act trivially in that representation. So there's another relation in this module. And this is given by another Chebyshev polynomial. So I have to define the Chebyshev polynomial TR of x equals cosine theta, which is cosine of r theta not divided by anything. So cosine r theta is a polynomial in cosine theta. And all we need to do in order to truncate or to give the identification that I had before on the tachyon is impose such a relation among Chebyshev polynomials as a statement about the ring element. So now let's do a little calculation of a three-point function. This is the basic object we normally do in string theory. We take three tachyons and we ask what's the matrix element of one tachyon going to two. So I'm going to express each of them as the basic tachyon. This is the identity, the simplest tachyon, and multiply it by an appropriate ring element. We've already learned how to multiply the ring element. This gives us integer 0 or 1, times some overall constant T1, 1. So this result is really amazing. You look at this complicated conformal field theory coupled to Liouville, two complicated expressions. And not only does the mess from one of them cancel the mess of the other, we didn't even have to write the mess. The way I derived the answer here, all these things didn't matter, and I got the fact that the answer is 0, 1 in a completely conceptual way. I presented all the relevant formulas here. Some of these values, these are the values which were computed in the 90s. The fact that they are 1, that those specific ones that were computed are 1, was noticed as a very peculiar, I think it was actually first noticed here at Santa Barbara by Gulyan and Lee, that there's such a simplification. And it was a big miracle. And now we, A, extend it for all of them, all representations in all models. And second, we didn't have to work very hard in order to show that. So this shows that we are on the right track. And I would like to point something else here. Everything comes down to these Chebyshevs. And most of you probably don't like Chebyshevs and don't want to know about them. But it basically comes to these trigonometric functions. The fact that this complicated and rich theory is really controlled by trigonometric function is a sign of an underlying simplicity. There is some free field in the story, which is hidden. We are going to find why the Chebyshevs are there, why there is a free field. But for the moment, we just observe this fact. So I continue now with this theme of collecting facts. Some of them are new about these models. And later I'll give a geometric interpretation of all these algebraic facts. So the next element I would like, so far I was working only on the sphere, there were closed strings, different ghost number and so forth. We would like to get D-brains into the story. So I need first to review what's known about D-brains in Liouville theory. So we change gears, we forget the minimal string theory, we have only two-dimensional field theory, a special one with this one scalar field, and it has two kinds of D-brains. Let's see what they are. The first is known as FZZT because of Fateh, Zamolodchikov's, and Teschner. And that was known in the old days as a macroscopic loop in the world sheet. So the world sheet is a disk, and we cut a hole in the world sheet, so that's why it's a D-brain. And along the boundary of the world sheet, we put the boundary interaction, boundary cosmological constant, mu b, times the length of the loop. Into the b phi in terms of the underlying world sheet metric is the length of the loop. So we put this boundary interaction, and this is some kind of a D-brain we can put in. Let's try and get some intuition what this brain looks like by thinking of the mini-superspace approximation. In the mini-superspace approximation, the field phi is independent of the coordinate around the boundary. It has just one value, phi. And this term is added to the action. We have e to the minus mu b times e to the phi. So we can say that we have a mini-superspace wave function for this brain. The wave function is e to the minus the boundary cosmological constant times e to the b phi. So let's plot it. This is a function when we come from phi equals minus infinity. This is the region of weak coupling. This is the region where the holographic theory is. This is the boundary. As we go to the interior, at phi of order log mu b, the brain dissolves and disappears. Pictures like that are figured recently in D-brain decay. So this is an object which looks like a D1 brain, ending at some point in the interior. And depending on the value of the mu b, we have different brains. We're going to vary mu b and scan the different brains. So the spirit of what we'll be doing, I'm kind of putting things ahead, is that we have this parameter that labels the brain, mu b. This parameter will end up being a coordinate on a new space-time, on a new target space. So our target space will end up being the parameter space of the D-brain. Think putting it this way, it's almost obviously right. We have a D0 brain, what space-time? So various points you can put the D0 brain. Here you can't put a D0 brain. There are no D0 brains in this system, but there is this D1 brain which ends at the point. So depending on where this D-brain ends, this will be our space-time. I'll make it much more precise. This is some kind of intuition which you might or might not like, but I'll write formulas for that. So the D-brain decays. Alternatively, we can think of it as a D0 brain coming from infinity and ending on a D0 brain.
Sorry, you don't want to set mu b to 1 by shifting phi?
I cannot do that because I've already used shift to set mu to 1. I can shift mu b to 1, but then I'll have mu everywhere. And I can assure you the equations will be much more complicated if I do that. It's really a good idea to set mu to 1. You do the bulk, you hold the bulk fix, and now mu b is a parameter that labels the different D-brains for the same bulk theory. I use different probes to examine the theory. Okay, what do we do with D-brains? Well, there's a formalism for Cardi, how to deal with D-brains. We label the D-brains by a representation in the open string channel, not in the closed string channel, by the open string channel. Ishibashi told us to label them by the closed string channel, and we can write one in terms of the other. So the boundary state, labeled by mu b, the boundary cosmological constant, is given by a linear combination of Ishibashi states, states in the closed string channel. So how are they labeled by a representation? We had a parameter mu b, and what the Zamolodchikov tell us, that we think of another parameter sigma, mu b being the cosh of sigma, and the representation in the open string channel is the representation whose dimension is given by sigma squared plus q squared over 4. It doesn't matter what the details are. There's a one-parameter family of representations that can be in the open string channel, and correspondingly, the value mu b, the boundary cosmological constant, is in one-to-one correspondence, almost one-to-one correspondence, with these D-brains. I say almost because the cosh has periodicity under shifting sigma by an imaginary amount, which will soon be absolutely crucial. But at the starting point, kind of semi-classical picture, sigma is real, mu b is real and positive, maybe even large in the semi-classical region, so that the brain ends near the end of the universe. It comes in and it immediately decays. We have a one-parameter family of D brains labeled by sigma. And the decomposition in terms of closed string states is given as follows. This is again from the value of, from the work of the Zymologicals. A closed string state with momentum p, with a certain wave function, psi of p. But the sigma dependence is very simple. It's a cosine. Notice again, a trigonometric function comes in. But in a totally different context, now we're talking about D brains, not about closed strings. Very good question. It will soon be on the next transparency. So this is the D brain. Now, we've seen something very interesting here. Normally, when we integrate over momentum with a wave function, which is a cosine, what we get is not a D1 brain. It looks like a D0 brain. So roughly speaking, this looks like a D0 brain localized at the point associated with sigma. This is roughly the point where the string ends. So there are two ways of thinking about this string. Either it is a D0 brain localized at sigma, or a D1 brain coming from infinity ending on sigma. But depending on the interpretation, this formula is correct. So, So we were here, now we come here, and since you asked me the question, I really have to answer it. What happens for this, the generate representations? And again, this is not some approximation where we work semi-classically or hand wave our hands about the interpretation. This thing is exact, and here there's no room for error. I mean, whatever you get, you cannot say that higher order corrections will fix it. This is the beauty of exact results. So the special representations are associated with imaginary sigma, given by two integers, as I said before, m and n. Here, the representation that in the open string channel is degenerate. So when I look at the, say, at the annulus diagram, I should not get the character of a generic representation, but I should get a smaller character. So for these values of sigma, I can form a new brain, which is the difference between a generic representation minus all the states I have to throw away. So for these values of sigma, I can form brains labeled by two integers, m and n. They are referred to as ZZ brains because of the two Zymologicals, which is written in terms of a linear combination, in fact, the difference of two brains. Normally, you do not subtract brains because the states here come with a minus sign. But if the states that are subtracted are states that already exist here, then it's a good thing to subtract them. This is the basic brain. Now, Emil Martinek noticed that although these points have different values of sigma, they have the same value for the boundary cosmological constant. And so far, it looks like a random observation. We subtract two brains. They have the same boundary cosmological constant, but they have different values of sigma. So we start with one. We analytically continue in sigma, and then we subtract. This fact will soon have a natural physical geometric interpretation. But for the moment, we're doing algebra. So we're just looking at the brain, the boundary state. We subtract. We get a new brain. So what's special about these brains? Since these representations are special, if we look at an annulus diagram with two such brains on the boundary, there's only a finite number of Virasoro representations in the open string channel. This is the first thing that is special about them. And in particular, if we ask, what are the open strings which live on such brains, we don't have an infinite number of them, but a finite number of them. So the simplest brain with m equals n equals 1 has a unique operator on that brain, which is the identity operator. We don't have an open string that can live there and do all sorts of things. These are very rigid brains, unlike the other brains, which could have objects living on them which fluctuate. So there are very few, and sometimes none at all, open strings living on that, on these brains. And in terms of the picture in space-time, if you just go through the formulas, the mu b that we have is of order 1. So these brains can be thought of as D brains localized near infinity. Intuitively, we had this picture of the previous brains as being like this pointer coming from infinity and ending here. Now we take such a brain, we do something at infinity, and we subtract the same brain. So the path that runs off to infinity is being subtracted off, and we are left with something which lives only in the strong coupling region. Another way of thinking about it, imagine you take a D0 brain, not a D1 brain, but a D0 brain. You put it at a point phi in the interior. The mass of this D0 brain is 1 over G string, which depends on phi, and therefore this brain would rather move to the strong coupling region where it's lighter. So you put the D0 brains in somewhere in space-time, it runs off to infinity, and it stays there. So these brains are localized at infinity. The first of them, m equals n equals 1, can perhaps be thought of this way, as a brain living at infinity. The interpretation of the other brain has been very mysterious. In fact, it was even questioned whether they are consistent. From this point of view, these are very singular objects. You take a D brain, put it at infinity in space-time, where the string coupling constant is infinite. This looks like a very singular object. And in addition, you said that there are different species of them labeled by M and N, but how can they differ by anything if they are at infinity? Sorry? So this is the story for the D brain. This was my review of the work of mostly the Zamolodchikovs about D brains and this theory. And now we can try and go back to the minimal string theory and ask what of this story remains in the minimal string theory. So several things happen here, and the first, which is interesting, is that B square is rational. The complicated expressions of the Zamolodchikovs about these D brains become very degenerate when B square is rational and simplify a lot. The second thing that happened is that the theory has very few operators. We're not interested in consistency with any random Liouville exponential or any random conformal field theory operator on this D brain. We are only interested in correlation functions of physical operators in the string theory. These two facts, the fact that B square is rational and the complicated expressions are simplified, and the fact that we have far fewer diagnostics, lead to enormous simplification. The first, which is kind of reminiscent of the simplification we had before in the closed strings, where we had complicated expressions from one and complicated expression in the other, but the mess canceled out, it's a bit reminiscent to this here. The first thing that happened is that as far as the matter is concerned, we can ignore the matter because we can restrict attention to the matter brain being just the trivial one. The second thing that happens is brains labeled by different values of sigma can be the same if they have the same value of this combination Z. At this point, this looks like a random observation. What does this have to do with anything? What about the ZZ brain? We can repeat the same argument, the same calculation for the ZZ brain. And we started from a potentially infinite number of such brains. Again, we can restrict to those which are trivial in the matter, and furthermore, the correlation functions of them repeat themselves, and we have only order p times q, or p times q over 2, distinct ZZ brains. So we have several surprises here. First is that the ZZ brains exist in the first place. The first of them is perhaps tolerable, but all the others, where did this come from? And now we are saying that, yes, a priori there's an infinite number of them, but only a finite number of them are distinct. We have a finite number of distinct ZZ brains. Let's act on them with the ring element. You see, everything is calculable. So we can ask what happens when we act on the ZZ brain with the ring generators X and Y. They turn out to be eigenstates of the ring elements. These ZZ brains turn out to be eigenstates of the ring element with eigenvalues, which are trigonometric functions. From this point of view, it again looks like another random observation. What does this have to do with anything? But it's certainly surprising, because normally when you take a D brain and you act on it with a physical operator, you do not get back the same state. Incidentally, this gives us a very simple derivation of all the relations in the ring. Let's act with another X, we just get the cosine square. Let's act with a Y, get another cosine. So all the Chebyshevs that I had before can trivially be derived from the ZZ brains. Another way of saying it is that we have a finite ring. If we think of the elements as being actual numbers rather than operators, we can diagonalize the operators and then we get eigenvalues. So when we have a ring and we diagonalize all the operators, the eigenvalues give us a representation of the ring. And the ZZ brains are in one-to-one correspondence with the different representations of the ring. It's a different set of eigenvalues that can be here. So this gives us a simple derivation of the ring relation. So to summarize, what have we done so far? So this is the time where everybody was didn't care about the technicalities or doesn't want to know about minimal conformal field theory. This is the time to wake up, because I'm now going to put all the random facts that I had so far and put them together in a geometric setting and make all of these facts very natural. So what have we done? We studied closed strings, and then we studied D-brains. And the D-brains present these two kinds of D-brains, the FZZ T-brains, which are lines coming from infinity. They are labeled by a parameter, the parameter telling us where the brain stops. And we have the ZZ brains, which were more rigid. They didn't have a parameter. And they could be written as differences of two FZZ brains. And finally, these were eigenstates of the ring elements. And the ring knows about these trigonometric functions, or Chebyshev polynomials. It's the same thing. So let's put all of these facts together. And we start from the disk amplitude. Let's consider the disk amplitude. It's a function of the boundary cosmological constant. So we have a boundary cosmological constant mu b, and we have the disk amplitude, which is z of mu b. We compute it at large x or at large mu b, is a well-defined answer, but it turns out that this function has branch cuts. It's not an analytic, a nice function of x, it needs branch cuts. But since we have the exact expression, this doesn't frighten us, we just analytically continue. So the disk amplitude is not a function of the boundary cosmological constant. Instead, we define y to be the derivative of the disk with respect to the boundary cosmological constant. Notice again trigonometric functions. So x, the boundary cosmological constant, is a trigonometric function of sigma, and the derivative of the disk with respect to the boundary cosmological constant is also a trigonometric function. And x and y satisfy this identity. That's easy to see. This is just saying that cosine of sigma, this is cosine of p q sigma, and this is cosine of p q sigma, written two different ways. It's not z. Z? Oh, the big Z? The big Z is the integral of this with respect to mu b, where mu b is this. It's a little bit more complicated. Yeah, it's been done explicitly. It's a linear combination of cosines and sines. Yeah, this we have in our paper a formula for that. But you know what it is. It's the integral of this. Yeah. But when you differentiate with respect to mu b, then you get something very simple. This will soon have a simple interpretation. So we have these two coordinates, x and y. And rather than saying that y is a function of x, we have something a little bit more subtle than that. Y and x satisfy a polynomial equation, which means that y and x take values on a Riemann surface. Or alternatively, x, as we vary x doesn't take values on the complex plane, but we have to go to the second sheet, and for every point x, there are p different points on the Riemann surface, differing by the value of y. So for every x, there are p different values of y, differing by this analytic continuation. Look, disturbed?
You might have thought that, just from the point of view of the Wolfie theory, specifying mu b specifies the theory. Where does this multivalue?
Well, even before that, you could say you might have thought that mu b is real. Why am I analytically continuing it to a complex value?
Yeah.
Well, to be imaginary, we do it in steps. We start by taking a sigma to be imaginary. So if sigma comes real, and then sigma becomes imaginary, it's still real x. So if you think in terms of sigma, it's obvious that and you can keep x real and visit the second sheet. Intuitively, if you make the cosmological constant smaller, then the length the typical length becomes bigger. So the Wolschit, the semi-classical Wolschit, is determined by competition between the boundary cosmological constant and the bulk cosmological constant. When mu b is of order the bulk cosmological constant, the Wolschit is getting large, and we can even have negative boundary cosmological constant. The bulk cosmological constant is strong enough to put it together until it's a certain critical point where the length becomes infinite. This is the point where we cross to the second sheet. The final answers are completely analytic at that point. It looks singular only if you try to restrict x to stay on the first sheet, and then there is a branch point there. But if you analytically continue, look, it's even polynomial. What more analytic than that do you want? I think your intuition is based on thinking of it semi-classically when x is large and real.
Just taking the fact that all series is an integral, but that, you know.
No, just look.
Sorry?
It is. It's meromorphic.
Right, but the
integrand, you're integrating with something.
But you can end up with something which has branch cuts, and then you analytically continue. There are many integrals that you do with the result of the integral has branch cuts.
But you think it would happen at zero, branch cuts should be okay.
Well, it starts not at zero, it starts at minus one here. It starts at minus one because the bulk is competing with it, and I've set mu to one. I think you're still objecting because you don't see what this is going to be, and when you see the physical interpretation of that, you would say, oh yeah, it's all trivial. But so far, I've really followed my nose. I took the expressions of the Zamo logical. It's important that B square is rational because otherwise I don't have this polynomial thing. So let me make it more dramatic. If you just take the expressions of the Zamo logical, they gave us expressions for all of these things. They didn't express it in this language, but they gave us these expressions. And if you just write it for them, it's an infinite sheeted Riemann surface. It's an infinite sheeted Riemann surface because you see you have here cosh of B sigma and here cosh of sigma over B. If B square is generic, if B square is not rational, you get an infinite sheeted Riemann surface. That's what the Zamo logical said. We are interested in B square rational, and that's why we get something which is finitely sheeted. So the question is not why are there other sheets, but the surprise is that there's only a finite number of sheets.
These Riemann surfaces aren't compact, are they?
Well, that's a question of what metric you put on them. You know about these things much more than I do. This is the complex structure. This equation gives us the complex structure of the Riemann surface. There is a point at infinity which is special, which will soon have an interpretation. Integrals often have that. Integrals even do things which are more interesting. They're Stoke phenomena with essential singularities you can get.
There's a special physical sheet. You're going to tell us that's not true at the end of the day.
Well, that's what I'm going to tell you, yeah. But this is very common in physics. Singularities in the second sheet, in the third sheet, have implications for physics in the first sheet. So you can either say, close your eyes, say, I don't care about the second sheet, but which is valid as long as you remember to take into account all the implications. There are things which are easier to detect by going to the second sheet or the third sheet. But so far, I don't know what you want. The expressions of the Zamo logical bring Sasha here and tell him you made a mistake.
Anyway, this isn't surprising at this point.
The surprise is that there's a finite number of sheets. I think not that the...
Why once you start...
That's actually the biggest surprise. Why did out of the whole mess... If you look at the expressions that they have, they're very common. There's a function called upsilon, which is given by some integral that they can't do, where the integrand is given by some ratios of gamma functions. It's really complicated. And it boils down to something so simple, essentially trigonometric functions. So what is this Riemann surface? It's two Chebyshev polynomials. And I didn't write it before, but let me review here. We had ring relation and relation in the Takion module. The relation in the Takion module was pp of y equals pq of x, and the ring relation was up minus 1 of y equals u q minus 1 of x equals 0. This came from the algebra. And the reason we had Chebyshevs here, there were some fusion rules and SU2 and this and that. And this was the relation which was true only in the Takion module. And now we look at a totally different problem. We're doing the disk. We're doing the disk and we find sheets. And the Riemann surface that describes the value of the disk, the function of the boundary cosmological constant, is exactly this equation. I didn't put it in. It, as an input, it came out, which is already kind of surprising. So this gives us another perspective on the relation in the tachyon module. What does this Riemann surface look like? It is simultaneously a PQ of a two-genus Riemann surface and a sphere. Here is a picture of it for genus 2. I took, in terms of the yellow is the Riemann surface, and here are two cycles which are pinched. So this is really topological. If I ignore the pinching, topologically it's a sphere, and there's one uniformization parameter, one parameter which gives us a single cover of the sphere, which is this Z that I had before. They call the FZZ T-brains were labeled by one parameter Z. Not X, but Z. X, with terms of X, we need to go to P covers. In terms of sigma, which was the natural value for generic value of B, we have infinite covers of the Riemann surface. But the proper Riemann surface has a single cover in terms of the parameter Z. That's as long as these cycles are pinched. If we try to open up this cycle, it's a genuine high genus Riemann surface, and I'll soon give an interpretation of what it means to have why the cycles are pinched and what it means to open them up. So we have a Riemann surface. Here is a non-trivial cycle, but this is really a sphere, so strictly speaking, it's not. So if we think of this as a genus 2 surface, this is a non-trivial cycle. So is it clear what the picture corresponds to, this, what the Riemann surface looks like? It is a degenerate Riemann surface. What are the D-brains? Well, recall that the disk had a complicated expression. So David asked me where I can actually do the integral. But the derivative of the disk with respect to x was simple. So the disk is really a line integral of y dx. This is the integral I did not do in front of you. So I claim that on this Riemann surface, we have a one form, y dx, which we can integrate along contours. If we integrate it along a contour starting from a reference point P at infinity to a point in the interior X, we get back the disk amplitude associated with the point X. This is the FZZ T-brain. Somewhat similar to what we had in space-time, we had a line coming from phi equals infinity, coming to the interior and stops at the point of order X. But here, it's not that there's something fuzzy around X where the brain dissolves, but it's a sharp endpoint. So we integrate from a reference point at infinity to the point X. So this is the FZZ T-brain. What is the ZZ brain? I said that the ZZ brain, sorry, with the degenerate representation, is a difference of two FZZ T-brains. So we take two of these guys, ending at the same point X, which looked previously very mysterious, different values of sigma, but the same value of X, we subtract them out. What is this? We have a contour line integral up to a point X minus the line integral which runs somewhat differently from infinity to the same point X. Subtracting them one from the other, we end up with a closed contour. So the FZZ T-brains are line integrals from infinity to a point in the interior. They are labeled by which point in the interior we have. And the ZZ brain are closed contours on the same Riemann surface. So we have closed cycles. We can integrate the same one form along the same along these closed contours and get another ZZ brain, another brain.
So in terms of this picture of your Riemann surface, the singular Riemann surface with pinched cycles, is the point at infinity one of those pinching?
No. So this is the next transparency. This is really a great audience. Always wanted me to. So we have B cycles. These are closed B cycles. There is a finite number of. Notice that I have no way to tune anything now. I told you what the Riemann surface is, and from this moment on, you can just ask, where are the singularities? What are the cycles? And they turn out to be exactly the same as the ZZ, as the values for the ZZ brains. So since you asked, I really have to give the picture. Here is the same Riemann surface I had before. Here is the point at infinity P, and the FZZ T brain is a line integral from P to the point X. But we can also get to the point X by going around this, coming back through the pinch cycle, and going back to the point X. If we subtract the two, we end up with a closed cycle. This is the ZZ brain. The ZZ brain, which was a difference of two FZZ T brains, is a line integral along this closed cycle. So it's very important that we really think of it as a Hyginus Riemann surface and do not eliminate this point so that we can come and go and come back. So again, I'd really like to stress that this is not something I invented. It really came out of the equations. It's not a conjecture. It all follows from these things. In hindsight, it's trivial. But this is really different than the picture I described before in phi space. In phi space, this was a line integral from infinity. This was some object coming from infinity and then dissolves over a certain region in the interior. And the ZZ brain was something very singular sitting at infinity. You see that we have different kinds of ZZ brains, those that pass through this pinch cycle and another one which passes through this pinch cycle. In general, we have order p times q over 2 different ZZ brains, which are one-to-one correspondence with what I had before in the algebraic part of the talk.
Which is now because you're going to call it spaces rather than just the general Riemann surface.
Yep. And then you'll see that you actually published that data.
Right.
Yep. Not in this language. So I said that the ZZ brain is an eigenstate of the ring elements x and y. What are the eigenvalues? I wrote formulas before in the algebraic part of the talk where I computed that. We also know the values of x and y at the singularities. Here is the Riemann surface. We have some x and y associated with this point. This point has the same value of x and y regardless of whether we come from here or from here. This value of x and y at the singularity of the Riemann surface is exactly the same as the eigenvalue of the ring element when acting on this ZZ brain. Again, not something I asked for, and this comes from two different aspects of the theory, the algebraic part on one hand and the geometry, which is another. You see how it starts appearing. Let's make it more precise. Here is a surface. How do we find the singularities? We have to impose three equations. First is the equation of the surface. But in order to have a singularity, the derivative with respect to y has to be zero, and the derivative with respect to x has to be zero. So in addition to this equation of the surface, we also have to satisfy two other equations. Recall, t is a cosine, and u is a sine. U is a sine. So if t prime is zero, it means that u is zero. And now these are exactly the ring relations. So the ring relations are a condition on the singularity of the Riemann surface. So we see here three equations. These are the ring relations. And this is the equation in the tachyon module. Now imagine we put lots of D brains. So far I put one ZZ brain. Let's put lots of them. In fact, we want order 1 over g string of them in order to have back reaction on the geometry at the classical level. Everything in this talk is classical string theory. So imagine we put a lot of them. What happens? Well, it's very natural now what will happen. The cycle opens up. The degenerate cycle opens up. Opening the cycle means putting a lot of ZZ brains there. And the contour integral of the conjugate A cycle around that cycle which opens up measures how many brains we have inside. Let's go back to the picture. Here we put one ZZ brain. Imagine we put lots of them. Then the integral around this cycle here measures how many lines penetrate it, and it tells us how many ZZ brain we have created. If the contour integral is not zero, it means that the cycle cannot be pinched, and therefore if we put lots of ZZ brains, these cycles can open up.
Okay, I'm getting confused when you start talking about back reaction. So this is supposed to be a picture of the target space. And it's effectively one-dimensional.
One complex dimensional.
Complexified.
Yes.
So what is the action which is governing this back reaction? It's not an Einstein-type action in one dimension.
Well, I don't know the answer to this in terms of action. I think I know, but at the moment I'll tell you that I think I don't know. As far as the paper is concerned, I don't know. But I know what happens to the topology when I insert a lot of them. When I insert a lot of them, the Riemann surface is deformed. I add another term to this equation such that the period around this A cycle around here is non-zero. is telling us how many D brains there are. And since this period is non-zero, the pinch cycle has to open up. We cannot have non-trivial period around the pinch cycle because then we just get zero. It's an interesting question to really do dynamics in this space. This space is not phi space. It's kind of T-dual to phi space. But shh, don't tell anybody. Okay, so
what was
yeah.
G sub S on
string? G string, H bar, one over square root of H bar, G string.
That suddenly
enter? I say if you put a lot, you have to put a lot of them. So far I've done everything at the classical level.
The Louisville theory that we started with.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of Louisville theory, I was working only on the sphere. Now I can ask what happens when I add the loops and so forth. But there's a parameter G string,
okay,
which labels the. I'll leave it as that. So again, the number of D-brains is conjugate to the operator that creates the D-brain. It's conjugate in the sense that the intersection number between the two cycles is 1. And so far, I had the system without D-brains, and that's why the cycles were pinched. If I add D-brains, the cycles open up. So now, it's again in the spirit of this audience, for the third time, somebody says something about the next transparency. David. Matrix model. So let's take the simplest example. P equals 2. These are in the terminology I had before. P is 2 and Q is odd. They have to be relatively prime. And there's an integer L, which tells us which model it is. There's an infinite number of such models. What happens to our surface? Our surface is a Chebyshev number 2. It's 2y squared minus 1. This is cosine of 2 theta written as a polynomial in cosine theta, times some other Chebyshev number Q, depending on which model we're doing here. What does this surface look like? See, in order to solve for y, we need to take a square root. So there are two copies of the x-plane. There are two copies of the x-plane, so it's a two-sheeted surface. And what are the singularities? Well, the singularities are of two kinds. There is a cut running from minus 1 to infinity. So let me draw that. This is the x-plane. This is the x-plane. And we have a singularity running from minus 1 to infinity. Recall, mu b equals infinity is here. We come in. When mu b is negative but of order mu, there is kind of a singularity. This is a branch point. But you really want to continue outside that. So the reason that it's at minus 1, I promise you then it will be natural for you that it's not at 0 but at minus 1. So this is one singularity. In addition, we have L different singularities. The simplest case is pure gravity, which is L equals 1. But then there's a whole series of other multicritical points. So let me denote these singularities here. There are various points here. What happens at these points? At this point, we still have two sheets, but the value of x and y at these points are the same. So we can go from one sheet to the other, either through the cut or through the singularities. If we just look at the equation, we take a square root. The only way this can happen is if at these points, y equals 0. This is where we can connect the two sheets. They have the same value of x. This is obvious, but at y equals 0, we take the square root. It's easy. So what's the difference between this point and these? Here, the polynomial on the right-hand side has a single 0. That's why there's a branch point. And at these singularities, the polynomial on the right-hand side has a double 0. That's why it's a very special polynomial. It has lots of double zeros. A generic deformation of it will open up the singularities and will turn them into cuts. It will be another bridge to the second sheet. So far, I've just repeated what was done before, but for this special value of p equals 2 and q being an odd number. Interpretation. Why is the matrix model? Now we think of it as the matrix model. The natural object in the matrix model is the resultant of the matrix model. Matrix has a matrix M. So I claim that Y is roughly trace 1 over M minus X, maybe plus analytic terms. I think it's plus V prime of X. This is some polynomial in X, so it's not interesting. So the singular part of the resultant, this is called the resultant. I claim is y. And indeed, if we integrate it, we get a log. This is the disk amplitude. So we should think of the y as a singular part of the resultant. this singular part of the resolvent has a discontinuity. Well, it has singularities whenever x is in the spectrum of m. This is where it has singularities. And these singularities are a cut running here. The discontinuity along the, across the cut is the eigenvalue density. But since I did everything in the continuum with the world sheet, so I found a formula for y, I can find the density of eigenvalues across the cut. So the eigenvalues live here. So that's why the resolvent has a singularity when we come from infinity and we hit this point, and it makes perfect sense in the matrix model to analytically continue. In fact, everything you asked me before about doing an integral, you could say now, not some abstract integral, do it the same integral that you, David, did for the first time for us, solve for the matrix model. And you do it for with x, and does x take value in the complex plane, or is it on the Riemann surface? It's clearly, it starts its life in the first sheet, but then the second sheet is born, and you have to continue. Okay, so this is the interpretation of that. What is y? Y, I claim, is a force on a probe eigenvalue. Why is that so? The integral of y is the partition function, or the disk. That is kind of an effective potential. The derivative of the effective potential with respect to x is a force on the eigenvalue. So at the singularities, we have y equals 0. There is no force. Let's explore this function in a little bit more detail. Let's take one eigenvalue out of this cut. OK, so this is the picture of the effective potential. If you just do the integral of these Chebyshevs and so forth, you get a function which looks like this. In the language of all this matrix model, this is all already double scaled. It's I've taken the continuum. I'm doing everything in the continuum. Now, normally, what people do in the matrix model is they do not turn on the cosmological constant, but they turn on the lowest dimension operator. All the features in the potential are swapped together, and we get something which has critical behavior, x to the L. Now we open up the x to the L to see L different stationary points here. So the potential has wiggles. That's because we tuned the cosmological constant to be non-zero and the lowest dimension operator to be zero. So we deformed it. This effective potential for the case where the cosmological constant is zero, but we turn on the lowest dimension operator, was given by Gross and Migdal. They computed it for the first time, and they found this is not the matrix model potential, this is an effective potential. And now we say this is an effective potential on which is the effective potential of a probe eigenvalue. We bring one eigenvalue, we ask what's the potential that it has if we force it to be at a certain point. And this is the function, except that we derived it from Liouville with his FZZT brain and so forth. What are the different ZZ brains? Why are there ZZ brains, which is a singular object in the first place, and why are there several kinds of them? Why are there several of them, and then once you have several of them, do we have a finite number of them? Well, here they are. They are localized at the singularities. They are eigenstates of x and y with the values of the singularities. What does it mean in this picture? They can sit at the stationary points of the potential. So we can take one of the eigenvalues here from the cut and put it here, or here, or here, or here. So here in this picture, we can have four different species of ZZ brains. First of all, not one, but not an infinite number of them. It depends where we put it. Normally, the ZZ brain is a rigid object. It cannot slide around because it can sit only at the stationary points. Which stationary point? Well, that depends on which ZZ brain it is. What is the contour integral? The contour integral is now an obvious thing here. We start from the cut. We run through the singularity. We leave the eigenvalue here, and then we come back to the cut. So we have these contour integrals that go through the pinch cycles. In terms of this picture with the eigenvalues and the potential, this is basically taking an eigenvalue from here and putting it at one of the stationary points. Notice that there's a slight non-perturbative instability because the effective potential is negative at these two points. It's below the cut. So far, I've been doing things only at the classical level. It's the sphere, maybe the disk. But now we see that some eigenvalues can leak out. I should stress that it's a finite number of eigenvalues, because this is already double scale, so it's only it's a slight instability. It's not that the whole Fermi surface can be drained out. The whole Fermi sea can be drained out, but only a finite number of them can move here. And it's also clear that imagine we put a large number of them here for the 1 over G string, then they will have a cut here. It will no longer be a singularity, but it will be a cut. It will open up. I've motivated it before using totally different considerations. Conclusions. We translated many features of this minimal string theory to simple properties of an underlying Riemann surface. I've organized the talk such that we've collected data, and then all this data was very natural in terms of the Riemann surface. In the simplest situation, all the A cycles are pinched, so this is a very special Riemann surface. This is something I did not do here in the talk, but we did in the paper. You can ask, what are the observables? These are deformations of the Riemann surface. You classify all the deformations of the Riemann surface, and you end up with all the operators in this minimal string theory, the operator including those at higher ghost number and so forth. So that is a one-to-one match here, which is nice. We had a ring which really controlled everything. First of all, it controls the correlation functions on the sphere and was responsible to their simplicity. In terms of the surface, it led to the defining equation of the surface and its singularities. So when you ask, what is the x of the eigenvalues in this eigenvalue plane in the matrix model, the answer, this is the generator of the ring. There is a ring on the world sheet. It's a world sheet operator. And this operator in the quantum field theory, in the world sheet quantum field theory, translates to the position x on the surface that is natural in the matrix model. We identified D-brains as contour integrals of a certain one form, and we saw two different kinds of brains, open contours and closed contours. The open contours are these FZZT brains. They depend on a parameter. This is the point where the contour ends. And the ZZ brains are more rigid. They don't have a parameter. They are associated with closed contours on the Riemann surface. And this gives us a Wolschitz derivation of the matrix model, and it adds new perspective to a theme that has been become more and more clear, that the eigenvalues of the matrix model are associated with D-brains. In fact, here we really started from the D-brain, and we got more and more features of the matrix model came out. I think this idea first appeared in the paper of Polchinski, was revived by McGreevy and Felinde, was made more precise by these authors and a few others. What else can we do? Well, since we started from the world sheet, we don't need any guesswork to do type zero theory or superstring. And we've done that in the paper. So this is already done to a large extent. Everything I said here in the bosonic string was done for type zero. And this was really surprising. A, it has exactly the same simplicity, the same Chebyshevs, in fact, the same surface. The surface is the same TP equals TQ. The only difference between bosonic and superstring is what values of P and Q we plug in. So in the bosonic string, P and Q are relatively prime. And in the superstring, we have different restrictions on P and Q. In particular, if both P and Q are odd, this appears on the two lists of the two models. So they have the same Riemann surface. It's really natural to conjecture that the two models are the same. In fact, you look at the spectrum of operators, you look at the disk, at the level of everything we know about the sphere and the disk is the same in the two models, even though the Wolschitz principle is totally different. In one case, we have Wolschitz supersymmetry, in the other, we don't. There's no contradiction about it, but it's a fact. It's still surprising that there is such a thing. We can extend that to C equals 1 and to C hat equals 1. So what comes out of all these is that it's essentially the same story. You know, you have two cuts, one cut, but it's basically the same matrix model. And the matrix model comes out more or less the same way, supersymmetric or not. But then what remains is to dig out the physics. And there can be a lot of interesting physics in this space-time. The space-times here and here are richer because they also have time. A very interesting question, which I guess was alluded to in your question before, is how to quantize the system. So far, we've done everything in kind of classical string theory. We would like to add the handles to this story. What would happen to the Riemann surface? So various people speculated about it. I can tell you what is not true. It does not become a quantum Riemann surface. That thing is wrong. But I think it's not completely wrong. And the nice thing is that in terms of the matrix model, we know what the answer is. So all that remains is to translate this answer to this language. And that looks perfectly doable, and we have a lot of results about it, but we're not there yet. I think the most interesting application is still to come, so that's in this question box. Stop here.
So in terms of this type zero theory, for those particular P and Q which exist in both, are there any differences that you found?
So far, we didn't find any difference. So let me show you things that could have been wrong. When you have supersymmetry, the operators which preserve supersymmetry are very special. They're known as supersymmetric ground state. And they have really, when you look at the details, they behave totally differently than all the other operators. It's precisely for those models with PQ odd, supersymmetry is broken, there's no such operator. So that there's no contradiction. What we did check is that the spectrum of operators is the same, the ring is the same, and therefore the correlation functions on the sphere are the same. The D-brains turn out to be the same, and they lie on the same surface. So here is another thing that could have been wrong. In the superstring, for every D-brain here, we a priori have two different D-brains in the superstring, depending on whether the supercharge comes with a plus sign or with a minus sign when we reflect of the boundary. In type 2, we have to sum over that because it's a gauge principle. It's a gauge symmetry. But in type 0, these are two distinct D brains. In these models, it so happens that by field redefinition, you take one of them into the other. One at x is the same as the other one at minus x or something like that. So lots of things could have been wrong for this duality to be true. It's a tree-level duality. It's string tree-level with different gauge principles on the world sheet. So we certainly don't have a proof, and many things could go wrong. We checked most of them, and they didn't happen. So it's like with every duality. This is the Strominger principle. If you don't shoot it down in 5 minutes, it must be right.
So does this give you any insight into C greater than 1?
There's another thing I should have added here is doing type 2, which is the next step before we go to, in order to go for C bigger than 1, we really need to do type 2, not type 0. And a priori, it looks straightforward because all the elements that I needed here, the world sheet, the ring, Zamolodchikov, it's even the same Zamolodchikov, gave us the answers for the necessary conformal field theories. The D-brains are somewhat different. They also have the continuous ones and discrete ones. So all these things are exactly the same. It's near the top of my agenda to try to do the same thing.
Sorry.
Well, type 2 is essentially the cigar with a certain twist. So you think of it as SL2, SL2 module 1. Everything is known about it. It's messy, it's complicated, but there are expressions. And since we know what to do, we just have to do the same thing for this type 2 model. And that will give us, it will give us what it gives us. It either will give us a matrix model or will not give us a matrix model. It will give us something. And if we understand that, perhaps we can go to C bigger than 1 and see what happens. I should stress that this is, again, common when we have solvable models. It's not clear what correct lessons to extract from solvable models. So my favorite example is the harmonic oscillator, which everybody learns in quantum mechanics. The fact that there are energy levels is generic and a good thing to remember. The fact that the levels are equally spaced is very special to this example. I don't know what of all the features that we see here are more generic, which can be extracted as a general lesson. What would be the analog of saying, aha, there are D-brains, and we should be thinking about D-brains? What's the analog of this from this story? There might be none. And if there is something, I don't know what it is. But it's nice to have solvable examples.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's just begin.